From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson's off today. Happy Labor Day to those taking a well-deserved rest and those at the helm. It's here and now. President Obama's at work. In China today, he gave his final appearance this morning at a summit of the G20, the group of nations formed to deal with the 2008 financial crisis. Of course, Obama's immediate challenge when he was first elected. Today, there was lots of talk of trade and the global economy, but also some pointed remarks for two world leaders. President Obama said he and Russian President Vladimir Putin could not agree on ending hostilities in war-torn Syria.
Given the gaps of trust that exist, that's a tough negotiation. And we haven't yet closed the gaps in a way where we think it would actually work.
But the very first question to Obama from the press may have thrown some observers if they're not following the storyline of relations between the U.S. and the Philippines. President Obama was asked if he would still meet with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte as planned tomorrow after Duterte actually swore at Obama today. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us from Washington. Scott, that got everyone's attention. Why was Duterte swearing at President Obama, and what did Obama say in return?
Well, in fairness, Duterte also swore at the U.N. Secretary General and Pope Francis, so President Obama was in good company. They are scheduled to meet on the next stop on the president's Asia tour, and the question to Duterte was how would he defend the Philippines' very aggressive crackdown on drug traffickers, in which some 2,000 people have been killed, in some cases without what we would consider in this country to be due process. And Duterte said, look, you know, we're not a colony of the United States, and Obama better not bring that up. When Obama was asked about this, he was diplomatic. He said, well, Duterte is a colorful guy, but that he had instructed his staff to make sure that any meeting they had would be productive, and that would mean a meeting where, you know, all kinds of sensitive issues could be raised if things were going to be off the table. The president suggested maybe this isn't the best time for us to be meeting. That would be a major step. The Philippines are a treaty ally of the United States, so to call off an announced meeting like that would be a big breach.
Well, that's to come this week. We'll see what happens there. But what about the summit? There was Stairgate, U.S. and Chinese officials, you know, fighting over the tall stairs that President Obama uses to come off Air Force One. The Chinese said, you can't. And so he had to come out of the belly of the plane with everyone else. He was actually yelling and shouting. What does that say about U.S.-China relations?
Well, good news. When the president left Hangzhou this afternoon, there was a full-size staircase that he was able to climb back aboard Air Force One. And his national security advisor, Susan Rice, was able to walk on the tarmac unimpeded by Chinese security forces. Neither of those was the case on Saturday. And that is sort of remarkable. Now, I'll say, as someone who's gone on a number of these trips, it's typical for there to be some protocol arguments right up until the last minute between U.S. Officials and Chinese officials, usually over how many reporters can tag along with the president and watch what he's up to. It's certainly unusual to see those kinds of arguments playing out involving the president himself and his senior aides and where they can go and what kind of stairs they can use. This is a case of China asserting itself as the a rising power and hosting the G20 for the first time, being very much on the world stage and being very concerned with appearances.
Right. Well, people puffing out their chests ahead of topics that might come up, and one did: China's overproduction of steel, major focus for world leaders. Just why, and what came out of that?
Well, this has been a big concern. China is producing an awful lot of steel, and not just competing with U.S. and other producers, but the fear, as the President Obama said, is that they're distorting the market. So there was a lot of talk about this at the G20, and there was an agreement to gather some data and monitor this and take it up again the next time the G20 convenes in Hamburg. Maybe some progress made on there, but anybody who thought that imports of Chinese steel were going to come to a halt, it's going to take much more time to play out.
Right. Well, and Scott, just progress in general. We just have a few seconds, but this was Obama's 10th and last G20. He said it goes by fast. He talked about how, in April 2009, hundreds of thousands of Americans losing their jobs, but that with diplomacy, international diplomacy, the crisis has ended.
Yeah, the president used a phrase to talk about his meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin: constructive but not conclusive. And I think you can say that about a lot of stuff that goes on at these meetings. There was constructive action taken, but inconclusive as to what the final results will be. And that's probably true of a lot of the president's diplomacy, whether you look at Iran or Syria or Cuba or certainly the rebalancing to Asia. Constructive, but we'll have to wait to see what the long-term effects are.
Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, it is Labor Day, which honors the labor movement, the push to get workers of the world to unite. But the narrative most recently has been that the movement is stalled. Wages haven't increased. Union membership is down. But the economy is improving. There's a push for a higher minimum wage. Is there a different narrative? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us now, as he does every Monday. And Derek, what kind of year has it been for American workers?
It's certainly been a happier Labor Day than past ones. It's been a bad decade for workers, even a bad generation, but it has not been a bad year. The U.S. economy has added private sector jobs now for 77 consecutive months. That's the record. Unemployment now has been at 5% or below all year. That is also good news. But for a long time, economists and economic writers like myself were saying, okay, we have job growth, but where is the wage growth? Well, here it is. Wage growth this year now is at its highest level since the Great Recession ended, according to Atlanta Fed data that I just looked up. So what we're seeing is that a lot of good news is aligning, not simply consecutive job growth, but also now a little bit of wage growth as well.
Well, when you talk about wage growth, what are you talking about? What kinds of leaps and from whom?
Well, most importantly, we're talking about wage growth at the bottom of the economy. Perhaps you've heard of these movements to raise the pay for the lowest earning workers, movements like Fight for 15. Mm-hmm. This is the push to raise the minimum wage in the richest parts of the country to about $15 an hour. This has made a big difference. Bloomberg reported just this week that industries that tend to employ the cheapest workers are now experiencing the fastest pay growth. So what we're seeing is a reversal of the trend that we're used to talking about in economics, which is the rich getting richer. Now it appears to be the poor who are seeing some of the fastest wage growth, the employed poor, I should say, which is quite good news.
Right. Well, and tell us where are you seeing this?
Just this summer and in the spring, you had Walmart announcing that it was raising wages. Starbucks announced the same. J.P. Morgan announced that it is raising the wages for its lowest paid workers. That mostly includes bank tellers. McDonald's made a similar announcement. Target did. T.J. Maxx. There are many pay increases that are done quietly. But I think that the fact that a lot of these pay increases were announced in very heavily broadcast messages from the CEOs sends a really interesting message. I think it sends the message that executives at these large companies are feeling the social and cultural backlash against the chasm opening up between the rich and the poor. And as a result, they feel compelled to advertise the wage increases that they are giving to their poorest workers, not simply give those wage increases silently and subtly, but hope to be commended for them. And that could be good because it could encourage other companies to do the same.
Will you give an example? J.P. Morgan Chase said it's raising wages for its lowest paid workers, bank tellers, by 18%. And they wrote about it in an op-ed for the New York Times. Jamie Dimon, the bank's chief executive, saying it was the bank's civic duty to help its lowest paid employees to combat wage stagnation, income inequality. But, you know, I can hear someone saying that's a bunch of hooey. They must have another reason for doing this, because why not do it years ago? The complaint about wages has been going on for a long time. So is there something else going on maybe as well?
Yes, there is absolutely something going on. What's going on is there is a tight labor market. And in a tight labor market, it is a good place for workers and not a good place for employers. Just today for lunch, I went to a salad place. I won't say the name, but I went to a salad place in Manhattan where there was a person employed merely to direct people in the line. There were eight people behind the salad bar making the salad. That is full employment or something very close to full employment if you have to hire people to tell people where to go in line. That is the sort of economy in which J.P. Morgan, T.J. Maxx, and Walmart are now competing. And as a result, they are forced to raise wages. And if it were merely a matter of generosity and morality, consider the fact that it was equally moral and equally generous in 2010 to give out these pay increases, and they were not given out because that was a weaker economy, not a workers' economy, but an employer's economy.
Well, but you do have the pressure from the presidential campaigns, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders in particular talking about wage inequity. You have that pressure. You know, companies sometimes do respond to shaming. But you say that you actually think that CEOs are feeling a tremor in the earth, a cleaving of the public into hardened camps.
The cleaving of the public into hardened camps is precisely what you described with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, who I should say I think are also structural creations. I think that we would not necessarily have the same appetite for Sanders and Trump if the last 25 years of wage growth were slightly different. But basically, it's exactly as you said. I think that you have lots of players, both those running for president and those running companies, who are responding to economic, macroeconomic realities, those realities being that you have lots of young people and middle-class people who are making significantly less than they were expecting to make or than they were making a generation ago. And as a result, they want to be on – they want to be seen as on the good side of this fight.
Yeah.
And they are not simply, in the CEO's case, raising wages but asking in the New York Times op-ed pages, no less, to be celebrated for doing so.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. And Derek, you also tell us this wage increase trend may not last. So let's celebrate it while we can. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.
On this Labor Day, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are courting union workers. Clinton just recently got the endorsement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the country's fourth largest union, but the last of the labor giants to support her. The others, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, the National Education Association, and the Service Employees International Union, endorsed Clinton in 2015 before she was the nominee. Initially, the Teamsters said they were concerned about Clinton's stance on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement, although they said they also don't like Donald Trump's support for right-to-work laws, which allow employees to work and benefit from a union's bargaining, even if they don't join or pay dues. Some people do resent union pressure. Just last week, a federal magistrate declined to drop extortion charges against four Teamsters accused of intimidating staff and crew of the TV show Top Chef. Let's get the view from the top of the Teamsters with James Hoffa, Teamsters president in Royal Oak, Michigan. President Hoffa, happy Labor Day.
Well, happy Labor Day to you. This is a great day for labor to celebrate, to march together. We're going to have a great Labor Day march, thousands of people being together in solidarity and talking about their unions and realizing, you know, what the American labor movement does for workers.
Well, and, you know, it might also be important for people to hear that again, because just anecdotally, asking around, I was surprised at how many people did not know what a Teamster was. So let's just start there. I mean, people know that unions are about collective bargaining, you know, bargaining for benefits for a larger group of people, but they're kind of unsure about the specifics here. So we know that the Teamsters started to organize truck drivers primarily. What's a Teamster now?
Well, a Teamster now is 1.4 million members, probably the most diversified union in North America. As I always say, we're A to Z. We're airline pilots to zookeepers. We have warehousemen. We have truck drivers. We have people that drive buses that take your kids to school. And we're very proud of what we're doing, the fact that we're growing in these very difficult times.
Well, you say you're growing, but your membership is down from a high of 1.7. And, you know, people are wondering, well, how are unions important today, given that so many more people in the workplace are striking out on their own? There are people who work independently, work from home, work contract so that they go from job to job. The direction seems to be for the individual, not for the group. Make the case for the group.
We just organized 2,000 parking lot attendants in Boston. We've organized 130,000 people in the last 5 years. We've organized warehouse workers. We just won, you know, 100 people at Cisco in Florida. Now, this sounds like a small thing, but Cisco fought us all the way. You know, there's the Ubers out there, and obviously the labor market is changing. But the biggest thing I would say is that people today with income inequality, which is the biggest issue, you know, facing America today, we really have to have people have a voice on the job. And unions do that.
Well, but what do you say to people who say, well, you know, we need something new and different, and I'm heading towards this year's election and asking you this. They say, look, you say you're for all these things, but despite the unions, we have the biggest wage gap. We have wages that haven't risen. We have jobs leaving, and you haven't been able to stop that.
Well, we're doing everything we can. I mean, we're one part of a huge economy. We create a middle class where people have good health care, good pensions, and good wages. American capitalism is so rich today, they have so much money, but we basically have to make sure it's shared with working people that work for these corporations, and that's what unions do.
Well, Jim Hoffa, one of the biggest American capitalists, is saying that he's the one who can provide all these answers for workers. And a lot of union members seem to be turning to Donald Trump. We have, for instance, Joe Jacoby, who's union representative with the Boilermakers Local 13. And he says a lot of his union members are turning to Trump because they feel they're being hit the hardest. Their jobs are going away. Trump's the guy who's promising he will bring jobs back. Your union recently and belatedly, some would say, endorsed Hillary Clinton. But Peter Knowlton, who's president of the Electrical Workers Union, says the problem with her is that she's been a free trader all her life. They're not for Trump, the Electrical Workers Union, but they're not going to side with Hillary Clinton either. And Trump is the one who first was saying that trade agreements were the things that were wrecking the economy. First of all, why Hillary Clinton and not Donald Trump?
Well, we polled our leadership, and the leadership came down overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. She's evolved with regard to TPP and trade. You know, she basically does have a record with her husband of doing NAFTA, but TPP is something else. NAFTA's caused a lot of damage. We've lost over 1 million jobs. A lot of Teamster jobs have gone to Mexico. You know, what Trump says about trade is attractive. But then he comes back and says he's for a right to work. Hillary Clinton has assured us that she will continue the progress that we've made under Barack Obama, that we'll have a good NLRB, that we'll have a Supreme Court that's going to be fair to workers, that we're going to basically keep the progress that we've made so far. That's why we're backing her. She's assured everybody in a speech she made recently. She says, I'm against TPP now. I'll be against TPP when I'm president. She knows this is a hot point for her. And that she really is going to have to stand up and basically change her approach to trade.
Well, but do you worry, Jim Hoffa, that both candidates might not be telling the truth to workers, that some of these jobs are not coming back, that these trade deals actually might be good for the American economy if they're handled correctly? As a union, are you also thinking, well, wait a minute, maybe we do have to think about how to go into this future economy? Maybe we need to retrain workers. Maybe we need to be thinking more about the fact that jobs may not be coming back. Certain jobs may not be coming back.
Obviously, all the jobs aren't coming back. We've lost 1 million jobs. There's not 1 million jobs coming back. But we have to assure that future jobs stay here, that good jobs, and there isn't an incentive because of the almighty dollar and the pocketbook to close down plants here that are working right now because they can make a few more bucks by moving to Mexico. We just had Carrier Air Conditioning closed down in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. 1,500 jobs. And guess where they're going? Mexico. What we got to do is to try and stop that. Let's close that gap.
Why did you wait so long to endorse Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think we basically wanted to poll our membership. We wanted to see how this is evolving. And basically, I went to the convention, the Democratic convention, and we wanted to see what happened at the convention, that she is evolving on these issues. And, you know, basically, whether it took Bernie Sanders to do it or whatever, but she has moved on trade. She's moved on a lot of issues where maybe she wasn't before. So she's probably a better candidate now than she was 2 months ago and 3 months ago.
Talk about you for a second. You are up for re-election this fall. The president of Kentucky Local 89, Fred Zuckerman, and they represent UPS workers, is challenging you and has been critical of you for not debating him. You sent a stand-in to a recent debate. Why haven't you debated him, and will you?
Well, not really, because he is such a nobody that, you know, we really don't want to glorify him. He's a person that is kind of a failed leader. In his own local, he hasn't organized anybody in the last 5 years except like 105 people, he said. So debating a failed leader is really, I don't think, productive.
Well, and in the interest of fairness, at the very least we could do is say his name again. It's Fred Zuckerman, who is challenging James Hoffa to be president of the Teamsters Union. And Jim, in that your response, we get kind of a whiff of, you know, this is serious business, but it's not the bare knuckles that it once was, you know, when during your father's time, when there were charges of mobster involvement in the unions. But some people may still have that image. What do you do about that? People who feel it's about, you know, getting a guy behind a truck and maybe twisting an arm too hard. What do you do about that image of unions?
Well, that's a perception that's about 30 years out of date.
Yeah.
We're very proud of where we're at right now, that we're a progressive union. We're basically out there with our communications to our workers, communications to, you know, NPR and everybody else to say, this is America, this is the labor movement of today, and we're out to make America a better place.
Well, in fact, do you feel a little bit of validation as we head into an economy where people are, you know, more individualistic? And we know the stunning statistics about how they have no savings, no pensions, no benefits, no plan. Do you feel that unions maybe are even validated, given
well,
that?
Well, we are. We're the ones that are making the difference. We're the ones that are giving people good jobs. Our Teamster members are not the ones that are being left at the post, like so many people that we read about that haven't had a raise in 20 years, that are working two and three jobs, that pick up the paper one day and said they just lost their job because the company moved to Mexico. That's what we're focused on. Well, how do we help those people and give them a countervailing force against the powers of corporate America right now that don't give a damn about them?
Well, and my point was that union members have retirement. They have savings because of the unions. Jim Hoffa, I hope this isn't indelicate, but I mentioned your dad, president of the Teamsters from 58 to 71. Colorful history, to say the least. You know, he was convicted for accepting illegal payments, served time, and then, of course, disappeared. Do you ever think his disappearance will be solved?
No, I think not. Unfortunately, almost all the people that were involved or might have been involved are dead. Maybe someday we'll find out. I hope so. So we have closure on that issue. It's still very personal to our family. And we have a great scholarship fund set up in his name. And we're very proud of his contribution. And we miss him. And hopefully it'll be solved someday.
That's James Hoffa, president of the Teamsters Union, on this Labor Day, his view from the top. Jim, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
The unions also gave us weekends and this holiday, so while there is criticism on this day, we point to a study from the Economic Policy Institute that showed that in areas where unions were stronger, everyone was paid more. Happy Labor Day. Hundreds of people joined a protest today near a migrant camp in the French port city of Calais. We've brought you here before. Thousands live in the camp, refugees from the Middle East, Africa. They're trying to get across the channel to Britain by jumping on trucks, traveling through the channel, and many truckers joined today's demonstration. The BBC's Stephen Chittenden joins us from Calais. Stephen, what's happening?
Well, I'm standing right on top of a very busy motorway, but it's not busy with traffic as it should normally be. It's busy with farmers, lorry drivers, business people, shop owners, all from the Calais area, who've brought the road to a standstill and are currently having a bit of a barbecue. They're having some lunch, some bread, some sausages, even some wine as they stand here. And they've come together in a sort of coalition of protest against what's been going on in Calais. They're campaigning against the disruption to their business and to their simple ability to get around by the migrants who live in this camp of about 9,000 known as the jungle on the far side. It's so near to the UK, there are so many people desperately trying to get to Britain illegally, and every night they're trying to board lorries, stopping the traffic, causing accidents, and today the people of Calais have said it's too much.
Well, at one point we remember reporting on the situation in Calais, and the officials, French officials, said they were going to take the camp down. What happened?
They did, but only half of it. The French government came in the form of the security minister and promised to bulldoze half of the camp, and now you can look across to the jungle and half of it is indeed bulldozed. It's just sand dunes and the remnants of a few encampments. But what happened was that all the people who lived there simply moved to the northern half. So we have exactly the same number of people living there as before it was bulldozed, but in double the density, and that causes lots of problems. There's ethnic tension between Afghans and Sudanese, Iraqis and Syrians. It's a terrible mess, and occasionally it does spill out into the town, and that's another thing that the local people have been protesting about.
Well, are there people there also who have some empathy? Many of these people are fleeing horrific situations, and we understand that there were 400 unaccompanied children found in the camp.
Yes, even the protesters marching down the road today say they have a lot of sympathy with the migrants. They say they're not anti-migrant, they're simply anti the disruption that they are causing by trying to get on board lorries to the UK. And they want the government to help them, not simply to bulldoze the camp, but to move them maybe to other parts of France, to offer them asylum within France, or even help them move back to their countries of origin, perhaps with a little bit of money. So they're making that clear. They're not anti-migrant, although there are certain elements within the protests today who were certainly anti-migrant, but the majority are not anti-migrant. They're simply anti this mass of disruption. They want two things from the French government. They're parked on the motorway and they say they're not going to move until they've heard from the government. And the things they want are, one, security for drivers on the roads around Calais, particularly at night when this migrant activity is great. And the other thing they want is a date. They want the French government to give a date when they will close down that camp.
The BBC's Stephen Chittenden in Calais, France. Stephen, thank you.
You're welcome. It's an absolute pleasure.
On this Labor Day, Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks are a lesson in working with your spouse. The couple's been married since 2001. They're currently touring with Tedeschi Trucks Band, promoting their latest album, Let Me Get By. This is the first track, Anyhow. We spoke with Susan and Derek in February and also asked Derek Trucks about his other long-term relationship, 15 years with the Allman Brothers Band, which ended in 2014 with a series of farewell concerts at New York's Beacon Theater.
I thought it was an amazing way to go out. The last show especially felt right. It was dignified and everybody stepped up and you could really feel it in the audience. I've probably been on stage for 150, 170 shows at that venue with that band, and it was certainly, if not the highlight, one of the highlights.
Well, you know, I feel I hear a little Allman Brothers every now and then, you know, a little Ramblin' Man coming out of the chorus and laugh about it. Just listen to a little of that. And Susan, you told Glide magazine as this album was being made that one song might sound like Leonard Cohen, another like Delaney and Bonnie, another like Derek and the Dominoes. What do you want the whole thing to sound like?
Well, the whole thing sounds like us, yeah. Honestly. I mean, we've kind of created our own sound from a lot of different influences, and I think that is really unique, and this band is unique anyway because it's a 12-piece band, and everybody really helped write this record in the band, which is the first.
Yeah, and I think it captured the personalities and the spirit of this big monstrosity. I mean, it's got quite a personality when it rolls down the road, and I think finally in the studio we were able to capture kind of what it feels like to be on stage and to travel with the band.
Well, I'll say, I mean, horns, two drummers, two guitars, you know, and more at times. Recorded in a home studio that sounds like it had a lot of retro in it, because you can, I mean, it feels retro. It feels like, wait, is that Earth, Wind, and Fire? There's a retro sound to it. Is that literally the technology in your home studio?
It's a lot of vintage gear. You know, we got our old Neve recording console. It was owned by the Kinks for a long time. You know, a lot of the gear came out of some of the old studios here in New York City. We picked up a lot of old microphones, reverb tanks, tape machines. So, yeah, we try to record the old way, which takes more time and energy, but it certainly feels better when you're getting to the end of the process of making a record. I feel like all the sounds hold up, and it has legs when you make records that way.
Right. Susan, the whole CD feels that way, but pick a song that where we can really hear what Derek's talking about.
I'm thinking maybe a song like Hear Me is really a very pretty song. It has a lot of different levels to it. It has everything from strings and acoustic guitars, and then it builds up with some Derek doubled and put some electric guitars on it and a lot of the voices on it. It's really pretty and thick and very analog sounding.
If you feel like I feel, then come on, baby, you must remember that we're one in a million.
And Susan, there's also the cut Just as Strange, which we understand your son inspired, because this is wild. I thought there was something wrong with my headphones at first. But it's like old school.
Well, I think the thing that he inspired was the way that we actually mixed it, which he started to listen to some Jimi Hendrix and some
Beatles records.
Beatles and some Zeppelin, and he liked how the voices were kind of moving around.
Yeah, I was in the car with him, and he's like, "Hey, Dad, you ever noticed that John Lennon's voice is only on the left side?" He's like, "I heard somewhere that you actually process diction better on the left side." And I was like, "That's interesting." He's like, "You think they knew that?" I'm like, "I don't know if they knew it, but maybe instinctually they did." So when we were mixing that tune, I was thinking about that conversation with him.
Well, we can't hear the left-right split because we're in mono, but let's listen.
I can't leave that earth alone. When I lay it down, I sing a song. Oh, I raise the devil on my own. Gonna stop singing, go on till you're gone. Just as strange to me.
Well, and Susan, you know, people think your guitar playing is right up there with your incredible voice. And we want to hear a little of your guitar solo from Don't Know What, but we read that it came as a surprise when you heard you were going to be doing it.
Yeah, I actually, you know, I don't really know exactly when I'm going to play on what. I just kind of am part of the band, and whenever Derek tells me, I'll do it. You know, because honestly, I mean, there's no comparison for me. He's one of the greatest guitar players in the world, so I'm just lucky to still get to play in the band.
I don't know about that.
Well, Derek,
Susan is ready at any time.
I am ready. I do love to play. I really do. And I was thrilled. But then when I was playing the solo, I was thinking, this is such a cool tune. And I didn't necessarily want to hog the whole solo. And honestly, he has such a great way of ending a solo. And I know my strengths and my weaknesses. I figure I'll start it and then let him finish it. And that's kind of what happened with that. Is there anything to be made of the fact that, Derek, you play Gibson and Susan Fender?
You know, I don't think it was intentional in the beginning, but it's a great marriage of sound. You know, the Fender is maybe a little more pointed, and the Gibson is maybe a little rounder, which is maybe our personalities a little bit too. Like, Susan is shooting from the hip, but it works great. There's times where she'll pick up other instruments that are maybe closer to the sound that I have, and it seems to not fit quite as well. So she, you know, she sticks with Telecaster or the Stratocaster, and it seems to be a great A-B.
Yeah, it's a nice compliment to the Gibson, because I used to play a D'Angelico, which has more of the humbucker pickups in it. But like Derek's saying, the two humbuckers together, they kind of equal each other out. So it's nice to have the separation, especially in a 12-piece band when there's so much going on. You really want to be able to distinct between the sounds. So,
yeah, you got to find your sonic space.
Yeah, and I like a rounder sound too, so that's why, you know, my Telecaster and the Strat that I have now that actually Derek bought me, it's a 1970 Sunburst, and I love it because it is warmer sounding, and that really has a lot to do with it.
I know that there are, just in the last few moments, there were thousands probably of guitarists across the country who just fainted and said to themselves, their last thought was, man, she can talk guitar.
Oh, yeah. She can talk amplifiers, old blues men, guitars. I remember I knew I was in trouble when we were first living together, and I called her from the road, and I found this old vintage amp shop, and there was two or three amps I was looking at, and I was calling to have her help talk me down and just pick one out. I was like, Sue, there's these beautiful old Fender amps. She's like, well, you should probably get all three because I need one of those. I was like, no, this is bad.
Well, you know,
I need help.
Well, Susan Tedeschi, I wonder, do you ever confer with some the other women who have trailblazed where you now are, you know, people like Bonnie Raitt? Is there ever any meeting of the minds kind of just to get advice from her or share experiences with her?
We've hung out a few times, but I guess I've never gotten to that point, but I would love to sit down with her and get her advice or anything from her. I mean, I really look up to her a lot.
You know, whether Susan and Bonnie, when they're together, talk about it, you can see that look in Bonnie's eye when they connect. It's like they know that they're doing something that's a little more difficult being women, and it's a very tight group when they are together.
So you're a member of that tribe, Susan Tedeschi, but also now this huge tribe with your husband. I'm imagining that if it weren't a great marriage, it would not work.
That's for sure.
That's probably true.
But, you know, people ask us all the time, like, how can you be in a band with your spouse or all of these things? And I'm like, you just have to marry the right spouse, I guess. You have to be the right person. You know, and there's a level of honesty you have to have with each other to do what we do. And I think, if anything, it's made our family and marriage and all of that stronger, you know. It's great to be able to do what you love with the person you're sharing your life with, too. That's a unique thing.
Mm-hmm. That's Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi of Tedeschi Trucks Band. Their new album is Let Me Get By. It's terrific. Susan, Derek, thanks so much.
Beautiful. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. We love your show.
Isn't that nice? Well, we spoke in February. It's here and now. And it's Labor Day, traditionally considered the end of summer, although Hermine put a bit of a washout on the East Coast, flooding in some places, riptides closing a lot of beaches in even sunny spots. A tropical storm warning is in place from New York's Long Island to Massachusetts, although that hasn't stopped surfers. But then, after this weekend's over, it's back to school and work. So how about taking a great walk before that, as one father and son did, to reflect on the passage of time? 6 years is barely the blink of an eye for the White Mountains of New Hampshire. They've defined the landscape in that state for more than 100 million years. But 6 years to a dad, that's a lifetime. As Sean Hurley of Here and Now contributor NHPR discovered while hiking in the White Mountains recently with his son.
We're in the car. In the Welch and Dickey parking lot. It's 2010, and my son Sam is 5. Throughout this summer, we'll hike these mountains once a week.
Daddy!
Yeah, buddy?
3 + 3 = 6. 60s! 60, 60, 60.
Okay, hop on out.
6 years later, a little less often, we still hike Welch and Dickey. 11 years old now, Sam shows off a newer skill. Reading the sign at the trailhead.
Welch Dickey Loop Trail, Welch Mountain, 1.9 miles. Dickey Mountain, 2.3 miles.
When he was 5, Sam would bring along his favorite marble, which always became a little plane. He'd zoom through the air.
This airplane is heading to a thunder cloud full of all different kinds of thunderbolts.
Oh, no.
Nowadays, Sam's imagination is gripped by more likely adventures. Prompted by a lost hand towel near the start of the trail, he comes up with a plan for this hike.
I want to see if I can find some things that people might have dropped, like, for instance, that towel. Like, remember you said you were running and you found a gigantic pocket knife on the ground?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I still have that upstairs.
Oh, you do? Oh, I thought you gave it back.
Who would I give it back to?
Like some random guy on the street.
Back then, the world was still sorting itself out.
Daddy, I thought you were drinking water, but really it was that tiny waterfall.
Back then, out of the blue, based on nothing, the sudden inexplicable exclamation.
Oh, no! My watch is broken!
Oh, no!
Now, Sam knows he's being recorded. He's self-aware, self-monitoring, is restrained, as we talk about the movie Everest.
I don't want people who are listening to this listen to us go into the terrible, gory detail of Everest.
I ask 11-year-old Sam if he remembers hiking Welch and Dickey when he was 5.
Not really. I think I might have a memory of me being in the baby Bichorn, maybe.
Yeah?
Yeah, maybe, but it's vague.
When he was 3 and 4, I used to carry him up Welch, down Dickey, in the Bighorn. My memory of those hikes is as vague as his. It goes fast, seasoned parents will tell you. I've said it. What isn't said is how dreamlike, how blurred it is. It's hard to keep track. of all the different little people your children have been. Who they've become eclipses who they were. But things echo. Old conversations recur, are rewritten. On both our hikes, now as well as then, Sam and I came upon two different trees, both stripped of the bark on their lower trunks.
This could be from a bear.
Yeah.
He's scratching in it with his paws. Or it could just be people pulling the bark off. That's hard to say.
Couldn't have been.
The earlier conversation from 6 years before isn't much different.
See all this, this tree with all the bark ripped off?
Yeah.
You know who did that?
Who?
I think it was a bear.
How did a bear do that? I don't see any bear.
At the time, we both sat and began peeling bark from the dead tree.
You know, maybe it wasn't bears. Maybe it was little boys.
No.
Maybe every time little boys come past here, they peel little bits of bark off.
No.
You don't think it's little boys?
No, it's a bear.
Sam's imaginary watch will likely never break again. His marble that was a plane has probably flown its last mission into the thundercloud filled with all different kinds of thunderbolts. But there are these trees in the forest stripped of their bark. And maybe it was bears that did it, or maybe little boys. And maybe one day an old man and his son will try once again to sort it all out. Was it bears? Was it boys? Or was it, maybe, somehow, us? For Here and Now, I'm Sean.
And I'm Sam Hurley.
And it was definitely boys.
Bears.
Go for a hike. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Jeremy's back tomorrow. Happy Labor Day. Here and Now.